Welcome to the Psych Specifics Podcast. My name is Kendall Abel, and I'm here today with the lovely Dr. Michael Hall. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Dr. Hall.
Pleasure to be here.
So in Psych 101, the students learn about different perspectives or subfields within psychology. For example, cognitive, social, clinical, and so on. What perspective would you say best describes your training or research area?
My training is in the area of sensation and perception research. Specifically, I'm an auditory perception researcher.
Perfect. So what specifically do you research and what drew you to that? I would also love to hear an example of an interesting finding from one of your published studies.
I describe typically to students and faculty alike myself as a psychoacoustician. This is a branch of psychophysics which is interested in relating something about the physical signal that you're manipulating, sound in my case, to somebody's perceptual experience of it. And I usually mention this to my method students that this is the psychology before there was psychology. Psychology as a field started with people exploring these kinds of perceptual questions, and the field actually grew out of the methods that the psychophysicist had constructed. Wundt's laboratory is an example of this. Wundt trained with a guy, von Helmholtz, and Helmholtz was responsible for being able to write a book on the sensations of tone, amongst other things. He also made visual contributions. And Wundt grabbed those methods, and during that time with von Helmholtz was also exposed to Gustav Fechner's work, who was now recognized as the father of modern psychophysics. So these methods were being used for a very different purpose in Wundt's research, but that's where psychology started from. And the types of questions that I'm interested in looking at mainly delve into the area of timbre research. It's spelled T-I-M-B-R-E, so some people say timbre. Some people, if you're in the highfalutin circles, they say timbre. Tomato, tomato, it's all the same to me. But this kind of research focuses on the nature of sound quality. How do we recognize particular sound sources? So we deal with musical sounds in the laboratory a lot. A lot of psychophysicists are frustrated musicians when they deal with sound stuff. And speech research also, looking at speech categorization issues, and then even work with some environmental sounds. So how do we distinguish these types of categories that we have an easy time responding to? What do we use to do the job, basically? A recent kind of research example that I can end up suggesting, which is a different kind of psychoacoustic thing that we were doing, was a collaborative project with some other researchers where we were looking at whether you could get a perceptual impact from normal listening conditions from your own skull. So normally you would think of the sound going through your ear, but if we're talking to each other right now, my sound wave is also pelting you upside your head before it could end up getting to your ear in some cases. So a little bit of that energy is actually traveling through your skull. It's been assumed traditionally that by the time all of that stuff attenuates as it works its way toward your inner ear, that it's basically rendered useless. But we're finding that there are huge individual differences in the type of energy and amount of energy that's coming across different frequencies through the person's skull. So there may be particular instances or particular individual listeners where this makes a more substantive contribution.
Very cool. Thank you. As you know, psychology is an incredibly interdisciplinary field. How do other disciplines outside of psychology integrate the findings or theories from your subfield into their own research or practice? And I'd love to hear an example of an interesting application of your research outside psychology.
Okay, so it is interdisciplinary kind of by definition. I mentioned this is a branch of psychophysics, so now we're combining psychology and physics. The really sad part of this story, or admission of guilt part of this story, is that I told students that when I was an undergraduate that I would care about physics when I stopped moving. And what did I do? I went to graduate school and I started learning about how physics had really good application to the type of stuff in psychology I was interested in. So the field is by definition a merging of these two other disciplines. As a result, I've found myself sometimes working with students from physics, in addition to psychology students, I also worked with music students, worked with people who are interested in speech specifically, and done collaborative work with linguists as well. And so the result is that you have probably three or four different fields clustered together. All this fits within the broader realm of cognitive science research, which is by definition interdisciplinary as well.
Right, that's wonderful. You get to work with all different types of fields just by nature.
Now, you would ask me for an example, too. So the initial one that I gave you with the skull research, mm-hmm. that started out as a three-laboratory combined effort. So working with a person whose primary background was doing work with music as a focus. Also, another researcher who was connecting with linguists and people who had access to equipment to be able to end up measuring responses from the skulls. And so that research wouldn't do well without their input. I can give you one other example. I had worked with an electrical engineer on the only project that I had that was an award-winning article once it got published. It won Article of the Year in this acoustics journal. And it was because the electrical engineer that I was working with, who happened to be a pioneer in the development of understanding synthesizers, he was able to fill in a lot of my gaps for some of the physical understanding and what our manipulations were going to do and how best to accomplish them. And I was able to end up filling in a lot of his gaps about how do we behaviorally measure perceptual responses to all of this stuff. So the result was a much better thing for the contribution of both of us. And that's the way I feel about collaboration, and that's why I feel about interdisciplinary work. To the degree that they can all get along together and talk to each other from their different disciplines, then everybody wins.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the way you describe it as kind of being able to fill in the gaps for each other and coming out to just make the best research possible.
Yeah, half the battle is knowing what you don't know sometimes. Yeah. And it's okay to admit that we don't know things, but then how do we end up improving upon that? We either have to take it all on ourselves, which could be a multi-year process, but if you don't have the benefit of time in a research process, what do? Find the expert, work with them.
Exactly, the benefits of collaboration. Mm-hmm. So Psych 101 fulfills the JMU sociocultural area requirement for general education, meaning that students are expected to understand people who might be different from them and the importance of multicultural perspectives. How do you think about the role of culture, different social identities, or multicultural perspectives in the context of sensation and perception?
Well, first of all, I think of diversity of perspective and the contribution of culture is a critical element for psychology in general. You know, how is a clinician going to be able to end up effectively doing their practice if they can't be sensitive to the different perspectives of the people they're going to be communicating with? We also find that different perspectives can be really enriching, just like interdisciplinary research can benefit from different expertise. Different cultures can infuse a different perspective as to how to approach any research question. For that reason, I've always been very interested in promoting diversity and sociocultural elements. Now, having said that, psychophysics is a subdiscipline, and psychoacoustics not being an exception to that, is probably one of the worst offenders for not really showing a big contribution of sociocultural perspectives and diversity to the nature of the research product. Psychoacoustics has been dominated historically by white European men in the literature. And here I am talking to you as a white person of European descent. And it's regrettable that this is the case because it means that a lot of different ways of asking research questions haven't been examined yet. And I can give you an example of this. Recently, I joined the Anti-Racism and Equity Committee for the Society for Music Perception and Cognition. And this committee came about when that society realized that the entire subdiscipline of music perception and cognition research had really been dominated just by that European cultural perspective. For example, pitch in Western music is a semitone system. So we have 12 notes within an octave where the first and the 12th are the same an octave apart or doubling a frequency. Whereas traditional Japanese music is based on a quarter tone system. So in that system, they have twice as many pitches as we do. To our Western ears, untrained for listening to traditional Japanese music, we'd listen to this and might seem like, hey, that sounds a little bit out of tune. And it's not. We just haven't been brought up in listening to music in that tradition. But think how having twice as many pitches could contribute to all sorts of different findings in terms of understanding pitch or understanding melody or rhythmic complexities within a melody. None of those questions had been properly examined because of who the researchers were that were doing it. So there's a definite minimal contribution of that stuff because it's really being driven by the very few researchers from those areas of the world that were able to do that research. So now they've drawn attention to this, shown how there's this, whether intentional or not, a systemic component that basically was ignoring a whole other set of how to think about these issues. And now they're trying to go back and address it and trying to create opportunities for people to explore those issues.
Thank you. Yeah, it's always really important to consider the role of culture. So thank you so much for providing that wonderful explanation. My last question for you, Dr. Hall. What advice would you give to yourself back when you were a student in an introduction to psychology course?
First, I'd say ask people lots of questions. Find out where the opportunities that you are most interested in could be. You may not know what those opportunities even are. As an undergraduate, I went through the bulk of my training not knowing what opportunities were even available in the department because I hadn't talked to people about them. I found myself falling into opportunities just by the fact that I had a few critical conversations with people. I found research that way. You know, somebody was doing independent research and they needed help being able to end up collecting data and summarizing it. I said, yeah, I'd be happy to do that. And that raised the possibility for me. I'm like, I didn't even know people could end up doing this with professors, really? And most of the time, it's just as easy as asking someone. I'd also say expose yourself to lots of different opportunities because you may not know what you like or you don't like until you try it on for size. A lot of the things that led me to where I am today were things that didn't work out. But then I said, well, I know that pathway is off limits for me, and so here's where I would do better. I tell the story oftentimes of how I thought I was going to train to be a clinician. But I found myself in a clinical psychology class after 2 years of work toward that end, asking questions of a clinical psychologist of how they developed a particular therapy. And they said, well, we had to do something. Nothing else was working. And I said, well, what does it do? He said, it gets them better at a rate of 40%. And that, for some reason, really bothered me. That's actually a really good efficacy rate. But it bothered me because I wanted to know what the process was, whereas the clinician was answering me about the result. So clinicians have to be results-focused people. If it gets them better, what does it matter what the exact mechanism was for how it worked? Whereas the researcher in experimental areas like mine, the process and the mechanism is the whole point of the exercise. And so I found myself gravitating more to those types of questions. Right around the same time, I found a book on a shelf while I was actually preparing for a paper. I was in the library, and in those days, that meant you had to end up being in the stacks where all the psychology books were. And a gleam of light came through the window and hit the binding of a brand new book. It was on an adjacent shelf, not the one I was looking at. But it momentarily blinded me. I'm not joking when I say this. So it was like a little moment where I was like, what is that that's doing that? And I went over there and it was a book on the psychology of music. And I had debated between going into either music or psychology early on. And I recognized at that point when I started flipping through this book and realized for more than 100 years, people had been doing work in this area answering questions related to psychology, but using music as a tool to do it. I was like, maybe I don't have to choose between the things that I like. Maybe I can merge them together. And so that 1 or 2 minutes ended up changing the course of my life just by this accidental occurrence in the library. So I tell people to keep their eyes open, keep open to experience, because it could completely change the direction of your thinking in a moment, but you'll know when it's right. The postscript to that story, I was able to end up seeing the author of that book a few years ago. She was invited to be a distinguished speaker at a conference, and I was able to sit down at a coffee table with her and say, oh, by the way, thanks a lot for writing that book. Changed what I do. And I've talked to a lot of my colleagues from that same time period who do what I do, and they all felt similarly on that was a motivator for them. I'd also end up saying that story reveals that maybe you shouldn't turn your back on any of the interests that you have. So there are several options. You can explore any one of them alone, or you had mentioned interdisciplinary work before. You can create sometimes a niche job for yourself by putting together the interests that you have in novel ways. And that could be something where you create the demand. So I would end up saying that that's another alternative for people that students don't generally explore. They think it's all or none. I have to be in this box for a category of what I do or this other box. Sometimes you can end up making a new box.
Absolutely. That's great advice for students. It's so important for them to recognize, just to stay open, stay curious, and advocate for themselves. And that's such a wonderful story that you kind of had this breakthrough moment and that led you to where you are today. Thank you so much for all of your insights, Dr. Hall.
Oh, my pleasure.